Thanks to everybody. A very wonderful interview we have for you today with Michael O'Keefe. Michael, did you want to redo my intro at all? You're of all the people that have been on the show, you've got a lot of acting chops.
Well, I thought the good thing about your intro was that it was brief. the bad thing is that obviously you've lowered your standards and you got me on your show.
What are you talking about? Dude, you are... So, if for people who don't... I'm sure a lot of people know, obviously, in golf, the character you played. They probably don't even know anything else about you.
Well, some people don't know anything about me. That's true. I would say the majority of your listeners wouldn't know that much. But there are one or two out there who probably know more than I do about myself.
Like your wife and your kid.
They're not going to be listening.
They're not. You're most famous for portraying not even just a character in a film. It seems more like you embodied a movement in golf. Can you just talk a little bit about that? And you know, we'll get into so many other topics, I'm sure. But tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the thing about Caddyshack was that nobody knew it was going to be what it was at the time. And it actually got a second leg or a second wind after an initial kind of, I wouldn't say flop, but more than a lukewarm reception. You know, it was not everybody's favorite movie. But then somehow it got legs. And that story is actually a story worth telling, and it's not one that I'm particularly up on, except to say it became obvious to me after a short period of time that Caddyshack was building momentum in the hearts and minds of American film-going audiences. And I could tell this because I would be leaving, you know, like church at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is a usual time for me when I was young. I would go to church at midnight. And that's not true. And anyway, I'd be walking home late at night, and someone would roll down their car window and yell Noonan at me. And this is when I began to realize that the film was starting to do well.
And how long after the initial release or like the production of the film was that?
You know, it was a couple of years in my memory of it all. But of course, we're talking about almost 40 years ago, Eric. Okay, I am older than Judge Smales was. Sorry, Ted Knight. When we did the movie, I'm probably 15, 20 years older than Ted was when we actually made the movie. Wow. I'm older than Rodney Dangerfield was when we made the movie now. So it was a long time ago.
So, I mean, I guess on some level I'm interested in, like, are you a little bit, like, over it? Like, let's stop talking about Caddyshack, guys.
No, not at all. Because, you know, one of the things that happened when the film started to take off, a couple of things happened. One was that I started getting invited to charity golf events, and this was probably about 15 or 20 years ago. And frankly, I hadn't really kept up with the game, and I didn't play that much for a variety of reasons. And it kind of because, you know, Caddyshack was made before golf was cool, if you know what I mean. Willie Nelson was not, you know, the Charlie Daniels band was not showing up at the Wingfoot as a guest foursome when we made Caddyshack.
Right.
And, you know, so golf changed over the years. But then I got invited to these charities where if you just show up and play golf, you know, they can raise, you know, I don't know, $5,000, $10,000 a foursome at these events. And, you know, that turns into a lot of money at a shotgun format where there's 18 foursomes teeing off, you know.
Right.
So that became a really easy way for me to contribute, and I loved doing that. But the real turning point for me came a little over 10 years ago. And this is a story I've told before, but it bears retelling. I was doing a pilot for a great writer, director named Mike Binder at 20th Century Fox. And Mike, you know, offered me the part, and it was just a wonderful gig. And I showed up for the wardrobe fitting. And pretty much the first thing out of the wardrobe designer's mouth was that she was a huge Caddyshack fan. To which I replied in my normal fashion, you know, thanks. And, you know, she read me in the way that actors are easily read. And, you know, the theme of acting is you tend to not want to be pigeonholed. You kind of want people to pick up on a project, say, for instance, that you did in the century in which you're having this conversation. you know? And so, you know, I was sort of like, yeah, thanks, whatever. And then we did the fitting, and she kind of read me, and she said, do you mind if I tell you why I mentioned Caddyshack? I said, of course not. Why? She said, well, my father just died, and for the last 2 months before he was passed in the hospital, he was dying of leukemia, and we would go and visit him, and we would put on Caddyshack almost every day, and it really relieved the tension. He laughed, we laughed, and we all bonded and had a great time. Well, that story really, really rocked my world. And I began to realize that there's something to be said for making people laugh. And that it's a rare and unusual phenomenon to be connected to a movie that has so much heat and power and legacy as Caddyshack does. And because of that, I have a wholly different feeling about it now.
That's such a beautiful story. I had no idea where you were going with that. And, I mean, I feel like we're done. The podcast is over. No, I'm kidding.
That's all we got time for, Eric.
But, I mean, no,
I've got to move. But there's other people I have to help in this world, Eric. I've helped you as much as I can, clearly.
How do you even reconcile that? I mean, on some level, like, you know, I'm like having a hard time even having a follow-up question, to be honest with you. Like, I mean, golf isn't funny, right? Why isn't golf funny?
Well, golf too. I mean, you know, you can see you can read between the lines, like the PGA, you know, the people who have a concerted effort in Americans playing golf do a number of advertising campaigns, one of which is, hey, play nine because it's quicker. And what they're really telling you is, okay, we know golf is boring, but we want you to buy equipment and we want you to go join a golf club and spend money. So we're going to give you this ad campaign. Play nine, you know. Personally, I love golf. If I had the time to put in 20, 25 hours of practice a week, I couldn't be happier. But I became a dad about 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago now. And so that's my, you know, free time. I don't want to have a good handicap and a bad relationship with my son, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about the movie and the point of that story, you know, it's a point that's been made before, and it's been made before in American films, you know. And there's a great classic movie called Sullivan's Travels. It was made in the 40s, starred Joel McRae and Veronica Lake. William Demarest, I think William Frawley may be in there as well. Lots of great character actors, and it's a Preston Sturges movie, screwball, very funny comedy. In it, Sullivan, being portrayed by McRae, is a famous film director who's been making all these comedies, and he wants to make a serious movie. And he sets out to make the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And you may remember that title because the Coen brothers pinched it. And wow. Made, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But in Sullivan's Travels, he goes on a quest to find out about the heart of the... At the time, they would have called these guys hobo. They wouldn't have used the word homeless. And he ends up in a camp where a lot of these hobo, homeless men are living at the very... towards the very end of the movie, after a number of really insane, funny sequences. And when he gets there, he's still convinced that he should be making this meaningful drama about the current economic strain everybody's living in America. And these guys in this homeless camp happen to be watching one of his movies. And they are laughing and laughing and laughing and laughing. And these are really desperate, hungry, unemployed, you know, near suicidal men who are having a really, really good time watching a kind of dopey comedy. And he rethinks his whole position and realizes, I'm not going to go make Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I'm going to go make another nutty screwball comedy and let these guys have a good time when it comes their way. So that theme is one that's been explored and worth revisiting. But especially in my case, when it becomes as personal as it became when I had that conversation with that wardrobe designer about her father. And now, you know, interestingly enough, when I held my, you know, my inner life, for lack of a better term, when I held my feelings about the film differently, when it changed, then different things started happening. You know, I started getting invited to, you know, do screenings of the film, do Q&As of the film, and get flown to like a little film community, a little theater community out in Colorado outside of Denver. They flew me out. 500 people show up to watch Caddyshack and want to talk about the movie. And you realize, man, this movie just for some reason speaks to people. And I think there's a number of reasons why. And the most salient for me, besides the fact that, you know, Bill Murray and Chevy Chase were just getting started and were comic geniuses, and, you know, Ted Knight and Rodney Dangerfield could certainly hold their own and were about to also score big, and Harold Ramis found a way to kind of, you know, shuffle that deck appropriately, if you know what I mean. But the real driving creative force behind the picture was Doug Kenny. And as you may know about Doug, he started National Lampoon magazine, wrote the screenplay along with Chris Miller for Animal House, then wrote the screenplay along with Brian Doyle Murray for Caddyshack and produced Caddyshack, and then died less than a year after we finished the film. And fortunately, a bunch of young filmmakers got together and made a story of Doug's life called Futile and Stupid Gesture, which is the title of that movie and a quote from Animal House that Doug wrote, which is on Netflix. And Will Forte does a great job embodying Doug Kenny along with Martin Mull, who plays Doug older as if he had lived. And Joel McHale plays Chevy. And there's some great, you know, insight into the making of National Lampoon. Like Donald Gleason plays Henry Beard, who was Doug's partner. So you get a kind of glimpse behind the scenes of what those guys were like. And, you know, they got a lot right in that movie. They really did a great job opening up that story, unpacking the story, as it were, of Doug Kenny. So, you know, those guys were onto something so cutting edge and so not only ahead of its time, but at the same time connected to the times. To this day, I would say, I would hazard a guess and say that if you talk to Seth Rogen or Judd Apatow or, you know, Paul Rudd or any of those guys that are doing Will, whatever his name is. I just forgot Will's last name. You know, if you got with all of them and asked them, you know, like, what were the films that got you guys started? You know, five will get you 10. They would say Caddyshack and Animal House. You know? And that's Doug.
Right.
That's, I mean, there's other people involved, obviously, but Doug was the one who really saw the way in which those things worked and how to make them work. And you can't underestimate that type of power and insight when it comes to writing, because, you know, it's easy to sit back and look at the film and go, that's hilarious. But, you know, try to go back to the blank page and then see the film. You know what I mean?
Right. It seems like one of the things that is really clever about the film, not even clever, but it seems one of the things that's kind of apparent is that, like, someone somewhere along the way, and it could have been Brian Doyle, it could have been Bill, it could have been you. I don't know how many people making the film deeply loved golf. You know, I'm curious about that, because it seems like within all the comedy and the stereotypical characters, there's still a deep appreciation for the funnyisms that happen on a golf course that you notice when you spend more time there.
Well, that would have definitely come from Brian Doyle Murray and his brother Billy Murray.
Yeah,
Billy especially brought his own peculiar insight and idiosyncratic genius to his performance, because mainly he wrote it all on the fly while we were there. And, you know, he's also another really important driving creative force in the success of the film. And, you know, and he's a good golfer.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, I'm sorry, Chevy Chase is a legend, and he is a terrible golfer.
That's what I thought was so funny, is that he is purported as the best player in the film. You know, he's got this, I think of that character a lot when I walk into my club and I'm like, Ty Webb, 68, you know, like, I you know, but he doesn't even play golf in real life.
No, he hates golf.
Hates it.
I mean, and, you know, it's a, yeah, and it's a testimony or testament, at least, to his capacity as an actor, because you get the feeling that he's this, like, scratch golfer, or, you know, one of those golfers that gives, you've probably met those golfers that give strokes back to the course. Yeah, they're actually like a plus five or a plus. I played with a guy and studied with a guy named Fred Shoemaker.
Oh, yeah,
he's
I know Fred.
Great book called, oh, he's great.
Yeah.
I've taken his course.
Extraordinary Golf, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And when you play golf with him, you're like, are you giving strokes back to the course? Like, what's the deal? He goes, yeah, I'm actually a plus four.
He's so good.
Like a minus four. Like, he's got, you know, he takes four strokes on his card when he starts. He doesn't get them off.
He's also just so kind. Like, anyone who's listening and you don't know Fred Shoemaker, check out Extraordinary Golf. It's a great, it's in the vein of Zen Golf. Michael, have you read Zen Golf?
I do, and I know Joe Parent as well.
Oh, he's
and,
such a great
I've
guy.
Had the pleasure of, yeah, I've had the pleasure of taking both of their workshops.
Oh.
And this is not to take anything away from Joe, but Fred is the golfer. You know, Fred's magic.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that's the kind of golfer Ty Webb is supposed to be. He's one of those guys that can see a shot, be a shot, and make it happen.
To your knowledge, were the characters based on any real people that you know of that you might have even met?
No, I'd have to deny that. And I only use the word deny because you said the phrase "to your knowledge," and all of a sudden I felt like I was on a witness stand. I could get in trouble for me.
I did spend the day in jury duty today.
The only loosely, the Noonan family would be loosely based on the Murray family.
Really?
Because they're like an Irish Catholic insane, you know, I don't know, eight or nine kids in one house running around, you know, blah, 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 like that. That, generally speaking, that's the one familial connection or real connection. The rest, I'm sure, are just conjecture. All the Zen stuff, that's Doug Kenny. He's definitely wrote all that stuff for Chevy. And, you know, Doug is also writing all of Rodney's stuff, although, you know, Rodney, like Billy, brought an enormous amount of improv to the event. And so he was more than capable of throwing in an alternate line that ended up being the line that was used in the movie.
What was the Dalai Lama quote ad-libbed? I heard that.
Well, you know, when Billy did that, I mean, nobody knew what he was going to do except Harold. And he grabbed that pitchfork and he just about, you know, eviscerated that young actor, Peter Burkrot, who was playing the caddy. He was scared shitless. Can I say shitless on your radio show?
You can say whatever the fuck you want, Michael.
Great. Well, he just about shat his pants because Billy was really poking him with that pitchfork. And he was like, hey, can you lay off the pitchfork? And Billy was like, why? What's the problem? Did you eat something for lunch we don't want to see? It's going to be fine. Shut up. And, you know, and then he just started laying down all that Dalai Lama stuff. And that was the thing, was that, you know, Billy would kind of come up with something and he would run it by Harold. They would refine it and then Billy would go out and do it. And then they would move on to the next thing. So if you weren't paying attention, you might have missed the fact that Bill Murray was hitting comedy home runs every day with stuff that he was writing on his own. And, you know, it was being shaped by Harold Ramis and Doug kind of off camera, if you know what I mean.
Wow.
So, frankly, I don't know how he did it. I mean, you could have paid me $1 million. I couldn't have done it. I'd have been happy to take your money, but I wouldn't have been able to do it.
So, okay, so you get a call. They say, we got a golf movie. What's your first thought?
When I got the call to play the part, you mean?
Yeah, like before anything had happened.
Well, first of all, you have to understand, there's a better story, though, than me finding out. Because I went through my audition process. I auditioned twice, once in New York, once in L.A., and of course I lied and told them that I played golf and I didn't, and I had to figure that out.
Really?
Yeah, but the real story, and this is the more fun story, is who the part came down to. Like, who are the two actors they were going to cast as Danny Newman? Like, it was between two actors.
I'm dying.
In your mind's eye, if you can think of an actor my age, do you know this? Do you know the answer to this question?
I do not. I feel lucky to not know right now. Who is it?
All right, so feel like off the top of your head, who is the other actor, you know, who might have played Danny Noonan, who's my age, who's now like a fairly well-known movie star?
John Travolta?
Okay, time's up. Mickey Rourke.
Whoa.
Yeah. So just think about that for a second. You know, it would have been like, It would have been like when Judge Smales said to Noonan, I guess you don't want that scholarship. He would have said, yeah, you can shove that scholarship up your fucking ass.
Yeah, he would have killed him.
You know? Yeah, or he would have decked him.
Right.
I guess I don't want your scholarship. And then he would have thrown a left cross and he would have gone into next week.
Yeah, and then you would have struggled with alcoholism, you know, on screen, and it would have been very strange.
It would have been an amazing. Actually, you know what? That's a movie I would have liked to have seen, is Mickey Rourke as Danny Noonan. That's a movie I think we should go back and make that movie if we could go back in time. I would cast him and just to see it. I would give it to him and just to see that movie.
That would be a wonderful experiment.
Do you make coffee in the morning? Let me ask you one question about that coffee you make in the morning. Do you know when it was roasted? If you bought it at the grocery store, it's been stale for months. Sad news, I know. You go ahead and shed a tear. If you bought it at the local cafe, you've probably overpaid for it. Here's the deal. Bixby, B-I-X-B-Y, they cut out our least favorite guy. They cut out the middleman. I mean, the truth is, if you are the middleman, you're rock solid, but since we're not the middlemen, we actually want to get rid of them. We're the men on the outside, or the women. Moving on, that wasn't supposed to take that long. They roast it the day you order it, and they ship it right from the roaster to your doorstep. Save on the price and save on the freshness. You get more freshness. More freshness, half the price. I don't know what the deal is. Anyway, I've been roasting I went to the roasting facility the other day, and my man Miles started this really cool company, and it's a high quality outfit, that's for sure. Also, it's like the Vice Balls of Coffee that Jeff wrote that. That's pretty good. I do like that. Better coffee, better price, and always free shipping. That's actually a really cool part of it. You get the free shipping. So there you go. Check out BixbyCoffee.com. That's BixBY.com. It's going to get delivered to your door. And, you know, once you get the coffee, you'll be awake for it the next time it gets delivered because it's a subscription thing. You know, you get it regularly. You don't have to go to the store for it. So anyway, check it out. BixbyCoffee.com. All right, everybody, Precision Pro. Here's the thing about Precision Pro. They got started with a simple question. Quote, why can't anyone make a quality rangefinder at a reasonable price? I also have this question. That was 4 years ago, and now Precision Pro Golf makes the NX7 series rangefinder that's been named the best value rangefinder in 2018. That's a big thing. MyGolfSpy.com said that. MyGolfSpy. Anyway, their rangefinders contain all the bells and whistles that golfers love without the bloated price that other companies charge. Because to be honest, nobody likes bloating, especially when it comes in your price tag. The NX7 Pro Slope Rangefinder is the number one selling rangefinder on Amazon.com right now. Is that true? Is it the number one? No one's in my house. Colt, Snowball, and Max are all in my house. Is it the number one? Check. Is Precision Pro really the number one selling rangefinder? I don't want to purport false claims. Colt's checking. Anyway, that's on sale for $218, and that's $30 off its normal price. Can you believe that? It offers slope-adjusted yardages, pulse vibration technology, which, as a human being, I love. I love pulse vibrations, good or bad. 2-year warranty. Dang, that's 2 years, man. That's a long time. That's longer than I've ever had a rangefinder. My last one was stolen, so if you have my rangefinder right now, it says Eric Lang on it. You're an asshole. Also, it comes with industry-leading precision care package that includes a free lifetime battery replacement service. A lot of script. I'm almost done, guys. Hang on. Any news, Colt? Still no news. We're waiting. For golfers, confidence is a wonderful thing. Doubt is not. Precision Pro understands that, and it's why their rangefinder is the perfect combo of performance and price. I love combos like that. Oh, my God. NX7 rangefinder is, well, look at all these reviews. Does what I wanted. Love it. Just what I was looking for. Price was right. From Lowell H. Danny B. says, I like it. We're reading real reviews. 5 stars. 781 reviews. Dude, here's the deal. They sent it to me, but I haven't had a chance to play with it yet. We're going to see. Right now, the NX7 Pro is on sale for $30 off at precisionprogolf.com. 2-year warranty, 90-day money-back guarantee, lifetime battery replacement service. Lifetime battery replacement. Whoa, Cadillac rangefinder with a VW price. I like it. That guy I want to hang out with, Major Duffer. Let's get Major Duffer on the pod because I want to see this. But the battery replacement service is crazy. Seriously, lifetime battery replacement service. For me. I'm just learning about this. Swing with confidence. Hit more greens with Precision Pro Golf. Guys, sounds like if you don't buy this, you're the idiot. So anyway, ciao for now.
Adidas golf shoes, y'all. I've worn lots of shoes since I started playing golf 7 years ago, but I haven't found anything that matches Adidas. It's actually very true. Boost, all capitals, folks, B-O-O-S-D. Boost is the best cushioning in the game, and they test all their shoes so that you get the stability you need for the swing that you want, or whatever. Whether it's the Tour 360, which is all around a great shoe, or the Adicross Bounce, that's what I like. I typically wear, I like the Adipure, y'all, because they're classy as fuck. And I also like the, Cross Knit Boost, y'all. It's an older model, but they look kind of fly. Everyone thinks I'm wearing running shoes on the course, but no, I've got stability and I've got little nubs to keep me in check when I over-rotate with the big stick. Everything that they make is so versatile and comfortable, but most importantly, they're all built to perform on the course. Visit adidas.com and click on the golf section or visit your local retailer. Maybe just go online, y'all. Who wants to go to a local retailer? Let's face it. To find the pair that's right for you, you can also follow Adidas Golf on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook for all the latest news and releases. Check it out.
So you go in, and are you, like, excited for the part, or are you like, ugh, it's a golf movie? I mean, where's the world at right now?
No, totally cool, because Bill and Chevy were already way on my radar. Chevy from National Lampoon's Lemmings, which had been on off-Broadway down at the Village Gate before, which I saw in high school. Billy was already on Saturday Night, so I knew about that. Of course, I was a huge Animal House fan, so I knew about Doug. I knew about Harold. Because he was also one of the writers of Animal House, if I remember correctly. And I may have not credited him earlier when I mentioned that, and I should have. So, I really wanted that part. And I remember the day I found out, because I was at a screening of this movie I'd done with Robert Duvall called The Great Santini with one of the executives from Orion, which was the distribution arm of Warner Brothers that was distributing Santini and would distribute Caddyshack, and he literally told me at the screening, he said, okay, we're going to offer you that part, it's your part. And I remember being like, oh, awesome,
amazing.
I was totally psyched. Oh yeah, I was totally psyched.
So, but you don't have a golf swing, so what do you do? How do you get the golf swing? Because you have a pretty good swing, man.
Yeah, so I went to the Wing Foot, and the pro at the time was someone named Tom Neoporti, who was a had a real PGA Tour pro career back in the 60s. So now, of course, it's in the 70s. He's the teaching pro at Wingfoot. He's got an assistant named Dave Schultz. And I essentially go to the Wingfoot every day for 6 weeks because that's where I grew up and caddied when I was a teenager.
No way.
So my parents and brothers and sisters, and I'm the oldest of seven, not unlike the Murray family. And most of them were still at home. I guess I was 24 when we did the movie, so at least five of my brothers and sisters were still living at home at that point. So I went back for the summer and every day got up and went to the Wingfoot and took a golf lesson and played golf. Then when we went down to Florida, I saw one of the Toski brothers. You may remember them. They have a kind of a legendary legacy in Florida golf teaching family, and one of them, Ben Toski, was free. And I saw him when I wasn't on camera, I was taking a golf lesson.
Wow.
So that when I got on camera, I was at least confident. And I actually had some moments like that trap shot that almost goes in, that was for real. Like that was a trap shot I actually hit, and I almost holed it on the first take.
Amazing.
I did sink that Caddyshack, the caddy tournament putt on the first take. A couple times, frankly, I thought my hips were a little out in front of my swing every once in a while, but they were ready to move on, and we didn't get a chance to, But I had that reverse curve back, that C curve that
they
had back in the day in the 70s,
The VJ sink.
So, and that was the goal, that really high finish and that way bent back. And we were hitting blades back then. You got to remember, it's the 70s, so I had these Tommy Armour blades. There was none of those, ping clubs with the 2-inch back, and the little assist you get from all that. There was none of that back in the day.
Right. Bad shots were bad. I noticed you calling it the Winged Foot. I've never heard it called that. I called it Winged Foot. I've never played there, but why do you refer to it as the Winged Foot?
Because if you look at their logo, that's what it says, I think.
Really?
Huh. They're kind of like the New York Giants or the New York football Giants. If
the
you know
Ohio
I mean.
State.
Yeah. That's something those that's what those football players do when they talk about their school, right?
Right. The wing
foot. Yeah, it's like that.
I like that.
My brother, by the way, just a sidebar, my brother Billy, who's a year younger than me and actually a great golfer, was the president of the Wingfoot Golf Club as an adult later
Whoa.
In life. For real.
So you've spent a large portion of your life, both publicly and privately, involved in some way with golf. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love golf. Like I said, I mean, if I could... You know what? I like that whole Shivas Irons side of golf.
Yeah.
You know, that Golf in the Kingdom, that Michael Murphy book. That's what I love about golf, is that, I mean, it is far and away the hardest sport. No matter what Ted Williams ever said about hitting a baseball, hitting a golf ball is harder. And when it goes right, I don't have to tell you. I mean, I don't have to tell any golfer listening. When it goes right, when you draw a ball down onto a green and it lands stiff and you got a, 3.5-foot putt for birdie on a par four, you're thinking, man, there's nothing like it. It's so beautiful. I think it was Arnold Palmer who said, golf is imagination through the hands. And when you can see what you want to do and then do it, it's really gratifying, and rare and makes it fun. And, like they always say, like that one or two, if you're a hacker or a duffer like me, those one or two good shots will bring you back the next time,
Yeah, I mean, so you wouldn't have been playing golf at all in your life had it not been for the film. Is that true?
Wait, I'm sorry. Can you ask me that question again?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, you grew up caddying and you had some golf experience, but was the film what made you kind of fall in love with the game as a player, or was that because you said you didn't have a swing yet? So were you just changing your swing, or were you sort of changing the way you
no,
felt
I mean,
about
I
the game?
No, I mean, I was nowhere near a golfer when we started that. After I had booked a part, and I would say that the film actually did give me the gratification of. Let's just say Caddyshack was my first date with golf. That's probably a better way of putting it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And
yeah.
It was a good first date. Yes, and it brought me back. And fortunately for everybody concerned, I was practicing safe sex at the time.
You were what?
I was practicing safe sex at the time.
That's important. So, that's very important.
As a parent, I can't tell you how important that is, Eric.
And so you're in LA now, and flash forward, you're doing a play. You're doing a live performance. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about this play. It's a Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Tony-nominated play for Best Play last season, 2017 on Broadway, called Sweat by Lynn Nottage. And it's a brilliant insight, written prior to 2016, by the way, and a brilliant insight into the kinds of social and economic forces that are pulling apart the working class of America even as we speak. There are it's a small ensemble of 7 or 8 actors. Each of them has their moment, and each of their stories is told in depth and uniquely. So there's an African-American woman and a white woman working for a steel mill, and they are both in line for a promotion to management after 24 years on the line as union workers. And then, so their story is centered around the dilemma that arises when the black woman gets the job and the white woman is not happy about that. And their friendship thoroughly dissolves around. Each of them has a son, and both of the sons are working on the floor of this steel mill. The management locks out the workers, and the sons get caught up in the anger and the vehemence of the pro-union movement during the lockout, and it's made very clear that they've spent 8 years in jail before the play begins. So then we follow their dilemma through a flashback where we first see them with a parole officer And then we see them before it all happened. So you see the lead up to this event that transpired that sent these two young men to prison. And I'm not going to tell you the actual event itself, because the brilliance, one of the brilliant things about the play is the way in which that's revealed.
Right.
And so I play a bartender who is the keeper of their secrets, as it were. The majority of the play takes place in his bar. And I have a barback who's a Hispanic, a young Colombian named Oscar, who's directly involved in this violent incident that sends these two young men to prison. And he also, we follow his track, because he crosses the line and takes the offer from management to get $11 an hour, because it's a lot more than he can make as a barback. He kind of understands that he's causing a problem for himself, but he doesn't realize how deep the problem runs until it's too late. And it's my job to sort of hip him to that, if you know what I mean. Anyway, Lynn Nottage, the playwright, is all over this topic and these characters that it is a wild ride, and it's a lot of fun and very smart. I think it speaks to the zeitgeist of what we're living in now, and I couldn't be happier to be working with the people that are, you know, all these other actors that we're doing it with at the table.
And where can people, when and where can people check it out? It's in Los Angeles. When does it open?
We do our first preview August 29th. We run through October 7th. We are at the Mark Taper Forum, which is downtown on Grand. And as the advertising slogan say, take me to the taper. So anybody who goes to the Center Theater Group website can find us there, pick up tickets, come down. And if they use your name, Eric, guess what?
What, they get no
They're
discount?
They're not going to get a discount. Yeah, but they will be able to get a seat.
What if I'm going to come on the 29th. I'm free. I would love to come. So I'll be there. If anyone out there wants to come with me, we'll come. But don't expect some type of meet and greet from Michael. He's going to be in character the entire night. Is it a tough is it a tough role for you? Or are you just sort of like, I'm sure some roles are easier than others. How does that work for you?
Yeah, some roles are easier than others. I would not say this is a particularly tough role, but it's a sophisticated little turn we have to do here. It's a real ensemble dance, and there's lots of overlapping dialogue, conflicting emotions. Also, the taper, for those of your listening audience who don't know, is what we call a thrust stage, meaning that it's like a three-quarter circle around the stage. So, like, at any given moment, you could have your back to more than a third of the audience in a very normal staging event. So you have to be prepared to convey all the conviction of your character while being turned around and not necessarily facing your audience. And that's an interesting little trick to turn. That's the fun of it. You know, the real challenge of theater is once you get it memorized and you know where you're going to go to do what you're going to do, then the real challenge is just making it spontaneous and real every day and finding why that performance that particular day is going to be the way it is. And when you kind of catch the wave of the day and you understand its energy and where the day is heading, then you can give a performance that's aligned with that. And then the other actors, and these actors are good enough to know how to do this, the other actors kind of jump on the wave with you, and then everybody kind of lands on the beach at the end of the play, if that's not too much a strain on the wave metaphor. And it has a kind of magic. You know, theater's ineffable. You know what I mean? It magically appears in this space where everybody is, and then it goes away. And then it's not there, and the people aren't there anymore, and it's over in 2 hours. And that's really exciting. It can be a real challenge.
You know, it's interesting. Like talking about characters, you know, I'm starting to kind of have a question about, going back to Caddyshack, because for the golf audience, it's interesting that Danny Noonan is he the main character of Caddyshack?
Well, he would be the protagonist, and if we had shot this screenplay that was originally written, it would have been much more about a coming of age story about Danny Noonan.
Right.
But we did not, and they realized when we got down there, I don't think much to their credit, Harold Ramis realized that he had essentially his version of the Marx Brothers, you know, and which of course made me Gummo Marx. But he had Ted and Rodney and Billy and Chevy. And when he had them in the room, he realized, oh, we got to go with this. This is the story, is these four guys and how they don't like or do like each other and what happens when they mix it up. That's the real story. And the Danny Noonan thing is, in a sense, becomes the story arc that you hang that on. Had we made the movie that they intended to make, it would have been much more like a coming of age story. But we didn't, and I think that's great because we have Caddyshack now, not the Danny Noonan story, which I don't think would have been. Even hearing myself say that, I go, yeah, that's not a movie I'd go to see.
Yeah, it is. It would completely change it. It would make it much heavier. I mean, because were you coming at it looking at this as an opportunity for a dramatic role or a comedic role?
Oh, hardly. No, I mean, we knew it was going to be a comedy. and everybody knew, everybody saw that coming, and there was no doubt about that. But it wouldn't. It would have been, there would have been much more screen time for me, which is a good thing. But frankly, I was still finding my way back then. I was
24
in many ways, and I hadn't really done that much. Certainly, had not done any leading comedic roles up until that point at all. And so I kind of had to cut my teeth. And if you go back and if you sat with me as an actor, I could say to you, ooh, I stink in that scene. Or, oh, I'm really uncomfortable in that take. Or I didn't like that at all. And I wouldn't just be – that's not just self-deprecating or, it's not like I have an issue watching myself work. It's just, factually speaking, we know as actors, we know when we have it together and we know when we don't. And it's very, very easy to see that. So having said that, I was really happy to be a part of the film and happy that, my character maintains a certain kind of staying power. But the real money in the movie is Billy and Chevy and Ted and Rodney. That's why the movie works.
Sure. But I think on some level, though, Michael, your performance and your character is I think what people actually relate to when they watch it, though, and that's what I think is really interesting. That's why I was thinking about, is it a dramatic role or is it a comedic role? Because your comedy in the film comes off much more serious than anybody else's, right? You're not a caricature. Everyone else is sort of playing a cartoon almost, and you're this person almost like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You're like existing in a real situation. You have real stakes, and at the end, everybody wants you to win. So on some level, like that must have been, I would imagine that'd be kind of hard to shoot, and try to, especially at 24, but at any age, really trying to figure out where's your, temperature in the scene,
Well, that's the job, and I have a, first of all, thank you for saying that. And I'm, to the extent that people are concerned about Danny and sinking that final punt, at the end of the at the film, then in a way, you're right. I did my job if they really want him to sink that putt and win the match. That's what we do as actors. And fortunately, and I haven't said enough about Harold Ramis yet, really. Fortunately, I had someone like Harold directing me, because Harold Ramis was one of the most affable, intelligent, visionary directors of his generation, and most people don't necessarily put him up there with some of our great American film directors. But if you go look at a film like Groundhog Day, you begin to realize just how amazing Harold was as a director. And I have to tell you how great he was with actors, because Chevy worked a certain way, Billy worked a certain way, Ted worked a wholly different way. And they didn't necessarily get along. Ted and Chevy were not at in lockstep as we went forward. And then Rodney worked a whole nother way. And it was Harold who saw a way to kind of corral all of their talents and bring them together into what we see in the final film. And it was also Harold was the one that was making sure I was modulating things in a way in which it would serve the story.
What, Michael, when was the last time you saw Caddyshack?
I can't remember the last time I actually sat down and watched the film. I mean, I saw it in the theaters when it was released in 1980, and occasionally when it's on television, I'll watch a scene or two. But, you know, I'm just not going to – I don't sit down and watch my movies. I have other pursuits.
That's a common – I've heard that a lot, and I kind of experience it too. Like, on a much smaller level, obviously, but, you know, like, I'll watch a clip of something. Like, you know, we do this show, Adventures in Golf. I'll watch a clip of it, but – it's almost like, I don't know, what is that feeling? It's like impatience or something, or like you already know it. And like,
well, it's work, you know, I mean, it's work for us, you know, in the end, no matter how great it is, you know. And I've had an opportunity to be in, you know, a bunch of pretty good movies besides Caddyshack.
Right.
But it's not like when they're on TV, like I might go, oh, look, there's Michael Clayton. I think I'll look at me do that scene with George Clooney. And then 3 minutes into the scene, I realize, oh, I'm thoroughly depressed because I look like George Clooney's fat, bald friend. You know, and he looks like a movie star, so I'm not going to watch that anymore. You know, everything's personal, and at the same time, it's professional. So you watch yourself for a few minutes and go, yeah, I guess I was okay in that. And then, you know, you move on. Or if, like, Sean Penn directed this great movie with Jack Nicholson in which he plays a detective who, on the day of his retirement, finds out about the murder of a 9-year-old girl who I play the father of. And Jack and Robin Wright and Sam Shepard, Helen Mirren, Vanessa Redgrave, Benicio del Toro. I mean, it goes on and on. There's just the list of actors in this movie is like, oh, my God. Well, I mean, I think I've seen that movie once, and it was at the screening. Right. And if it's on TV, I'm like, oh, cool, there's that. That's great. But, you know, you don't go back and, like, I don't know. To me, it's not something I particularly enjoy, because I just think about, oh, did I really do what I wanted to do there? And, you know, or the fun part is when it is fun, you can go like, oh, I remember that day. That was the day we were in Vancouver and there was a horrible snowstorm, and we had to all of a sudden improvise this snowstorm into the movie, that kind of thing.
Right. It's not an escape.
It's gratifying, but it's work too, yeah, in the end, you know?
Yeah, everybody else watches it and they get to escape from reality, whereas you're just sort of further plunged into your own reality of an actor.
In a way, like one of the things I like, Bill Haber's got a great series on Netflix now. I forgot the name of it for a second, but it's about a hitman who wants to be an actor. And Henry Winkler's in it. Henry Winkler is knocking this thing out of the park, by the way. And Stephen Root, one of my favorite actors in the world, is in it. And Haber is really good. He plays a guy who's essentially Stephen Root's, like, his, you know, control in some, you know, three-digit government agency that sends off people to kill the people that are standing in the way of the American interests. And Haber is kind of wanting to be an actor, you know what I mean? So he's trying to juggle getting an offer to do a dog food commercial and be a hitman, you know? And it's really, really funny. But generally speaking, I really don't like movies about the business. Like, I won't sit still for a show like that unless it's amazing. And this one is. Barry, that's what it's called. It's called Barry. I'm so glad I remembered the name of that.
What about Bowfinger? You like Bowfinger?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I did, because I thought they got that right.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
You know, that's sort of like, let's just pretend to make a movie here.
Right.
You know, that part was funny.
So what do you watch? Like, what are you watching right now? What are you like obsessed with in your life right now? Is this watches?
Well, because I have a 5-year-old. No, I have a 5-year-old son. You know, I'm trying to get him to watch BBC documentaries about Blue Planet, you know, as opposed to Dinosaur King.
Right.
Which doesn't necessarily speak to my deepest needs. Whereas if he and I are watching David Attenborough talk about the habit of a chameleon and its capacity to extend its tongue, you know, 36 inches and grab a grasshopper off a tree, and my son's interested and I'm interested, well, that makes for good TV watching.
Dude, I love Planet Earth.
I just watched the Wachowskis' Netflix series called Sense8.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was amazing.
That's the Matrix, the Matrix guys, right? Or the Matrix.
Yeah.
It was the Matrix guys. Yeah. Now it's the Matrix brother and sister.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're pretty gender fluid now. It's hard to talk about them as brothers, yeah, sisters, brother, sister, or sisters. I'm not sure how we...
They're out of the Matrix.
How I do that without stepping on some... Yeah, without the appropriate pronoun. But, you know, the or, you know, in this case, noun.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about that movie, the series, sorry, Sense8, that was really genius. I love premises like, you know, there's eight people who are psychically connected. They don't realize they're psychically connected. Some of them don't even realize they're psychic, and now they're going to have to figure out how to utilize those powers, and it turns out survive because there's an entity that's trying to kill them. And
yeah, don't spoil it for me. I'm going to start it tonight.
Oh, and let me tell you something. It's amazing because one of them is a cop in Chicago, and the other is a DJ from Iceland. One is a bus driver in Africa. One is a movie star in Mexico. One is a transgender woman in San Francisco who's a hacker. So they all get their due, and it's an international cast with international locations that are filmed. There's so much production value. Also, great music, great party sequences, and I have to say, very erotic. And it was also the Mexican movie star's story is actually particularly poignant because he's gay and he's living a hidden life. And it, through a set of circumstances that I won't plot spoil for you, he's outed. And it's one of the first times I watched a film about a gay man being outed that I actually really got caught up in what it means for him and how his life has changed. And this actor who plays him, his name is escaping me, I feel bad about that, he really brings this really deep insight to the performance. And when he and his lover are confronted with having to go public, it's really mind-blowing.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to start it tonight. I'm going to go cook some chicken from ButcherBox. Hey-o. And then I'm going to make some popcorn. And then I'm going to watch Sense8. Because, you know, my neighbor has been telling me to watch Sense8 for the past, like, 6 months. Maybe not that long.
They're right.
They're right. What? They're right. When are you going to play golf next? What do you got? What any plans?
Right now, never. You know, the only time I've actually played golf in the last 2 or 3 years, I got asked to go play with Sergio Garcia in the Pro-Am at the LA Open a couple of years ago, and that was the last time I played. And that was it was the year that he won the Masters, so that was a lot of fun.
Whoa.
But frankly, I don't have the – I'm working too much, you know, which, you know, I thank my lucky stars I'm working too much. And when I'm not working, you know, I try to spend time with my kid and be there for him because, you know, this childhood thing is flying by, as they say, you know, in the wink of an eye. I'm sure he's going to be – I think the event that I'll be looking forward to in a sense, or at least planning on, is the day he gets his driver's license, because then I think our bond may distinctly change at that point.
Cat's cradle, man.
Until then, man, I'm going to be there 24/7 when I can.
Yeah.
For him. And that's actually one of the great things about being an actor is that even when you work a lot, you don't work all the year. So I do get like long stretches of time where like I'm the one driving my kid to school every morning and dropping him off and picking him up and ask him how his day was. And I know the name of all his friends and all his teachers and all of his activities. And, you know, I know that Monday's a gym day and Tuesday's a library day and Wednesday is an art day. And, you know, Thursday afternoon after school, there's soccer practice because I'm the one taking them there. And, you know, in the end, being a parent is the most gratifying thing that's ever happened to me. And I'm very grateful to have him in my life. And, you know, he and his mother are really the loves of my life. So I'm a pretty lucky guy.
That's awesome, man. The way you describe that is really beautiful and makes me, like, look forward to that.
Go for it, dude.
Yeah. Moving on.
You know,
no more therapy.
I'm 63 and I'm still I'm 63. I'm still firing lead bullets. You never know. I might have another one.
I love that, dude. I'm 37. So wait, you were 58 when you had your first kid?
Yeah.
That is so fucking inspiring right now. I have 21 years, yeah. Michael.
Think about it.
Quick question. So you play golf with Sergio. Did you text him when he won the Masters?
Well, you know, I had a great time with Sergio, but I have to say he did not give me his phone number. When
You didn't ask. You should have just been like, give me your number, Sergio.
So I can't say I texted him, but I did do a movie with Mark Wahlberg this year. So I'll just ask Mark to text him.
Mark will fire it off. How's he to work with? He's a hard worker, I've heard.
Oh, man, this guy does not stop working.
Yeah, he's just always
he's got
doing
movies
something.
Lined up from, he's going to be doing leading roles until he's 63 years old like me.
So, you know, Mark,
he's booked until 2040.
He plays a lot at Wilshire. I think I don't know if he's currently a member. It's at my club over in Hancock Park. I don't know if you've ever played it. You're more than welcome to join. Bring your 5-year-old. He plays there a lot. And apparently his MO is he plays with two caddies and he runs.
Yeah. No, he'll do like 9 holes in like under an hour.
Easily.
Like he'll do crazy. He's like, yeah, I played the other day. I got finished 18 and 138. I was like, what did you just say?
Yeah, crazy.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
Crazy. So have you played golf in Scotland at all? Or we're almost done. Don't worry. I know you got to go. But maybe
I played in Ireland. I played Royal Portrush in Ireland, which was fantastic.
Yeah.
By the way, go online and look at my Twitter account if you can.
Yeah.
And I posted a couple of years ago. My wife did a photo mashup of me and Rory McIlroy. He is a dead ringer for Danny Noonan.
Yes. Back in the
go
day.
Go back and look at that. I did a photo mashup. It's like, oh, my God.
What is
I actually sent them over to Linda Cohen at ESPN. I was like, is anybody else picking up on this? But come on, Rory McIlroy is Danny Noonan come to life.
Hilarious. He is. He was kind of nerdy, and then all of a sudden, just a stud. What? So for the people who are listening, they can follow you on Twitter, wherever. What is the – where else can they follow you? How do they type the letters?
My Twitter handle is MokeefMan, MokeefMan. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. And I'm at the Taper, man. Come on down.
I'm going to be there. I'm serious, man. I'm going to be there on the 29th. I would love to I'd love to say hi, because so far we haven't actually met face-to-face. So if that's possible, I suppose we can discuss those details not on the podcast.
Well, it's like the traditional, like you've seen in the movies. There's this thing called the stage door. You just go there. And you go inside and say, hey, I'm here to see Michael O'Keefe. And then, you know, we hang out afterwards.
Okay. Those of you in L.A., don't do that, because you're going to get turned away. The only person you can get in is me. Okay. anything else? Any great story? You ever have a hole in one? Any great golf story you want to leave us with at the very end?
Well, you know, I think your listeners will appreciate my brevity when I say, hey, do the ball.
Whoa. That's awesome. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for your time. I wish we had more of it always. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in a couple weeks.
Okay, Eric. Take care, man.
Thanks.